This is Directional, a podcast about video games and the creative rebellion. With Chantal Ryan and Jörg Tittle.
Chantal, do you want to start? Do I start?
You are going to start.
I'm going to start. Okay. Well, here we are again. Coming from all sorts of crazy places into this new one. And we're going to talk to someone really exciting. But first, here's Chantal.
Oh, thank you for that, Jörg. I am Chantal Ryan. I am an anthropologist / studio director over at We Have Always Lived in the Forest, and we are going to be talking about creativity and rebellion and original thinking in the entertainment industry and beyond. You want to introduce yourself, Jörg?
I am Jörg. Tittle is my last name, which is both names are really kind of weird if you really think about it, but I decided not to change them because what's the point? And I make games and movies and theater and comics and other things, and sort of stumble through life trying to tell stories and trying to inspire, and somehow it hasn't felt like enough. And also I'm fed up with having to promote my own work all the time. And so I thought it'd be far more interesting to hear about what other people have to say. And so here we are.
Here we are. And we have somebody very exciting, as you mentioned. And that would be Lee Alexander, who is quite storied and historied across the games industry and just media in general. I will let you introduce yourself, Lee, because you're going to do it a lot better than me.
Oh, man. You made me feel old just now. I'm still excited to find out who the exciting guest is. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Lee Alexander. I am a narrative designer and a former games and technology culture and news journalist. And I also kind of write speculative fiction. I'm really passionate about genre. I'm passionate about procedural generation. And just excited to talk about, telling stories in these times and the work of meaning making.
Yay. See, I knew you'd do it so much better than I would. And now I'm really, really excited to talk about a whole bunch of things that you just talked about, because that is my jam too, especially procedurally generated.
I know. It feels like we have a lot of common interest, actually.
You have, not only do you have common interests, in my view, from looking at both your output creatively and also your expressions on social media and
my
beyond.
Tweets.
The discourse.
I really value your voice. And they say, oh, you like my unhinged tweets.
Yeah.
Spicy tweets. Fuck
but
yeah.
But I actually adore that about you, Lee, because you are one of the few people I know who is just as sort of unhinged on Twitter as I am.
All right, so I get to be on this podcast because of my advanced age and unhinged personality. I'm already enjoying myself. Great. Please.
No, because it's honest. You're honest.
I'm really fascinated with realism, like in the social media and the post-reality climate. Each of us sort of has and always has had like a second version of ourselves, and I'm interested in how much we mediate that process and how we do that. Just so you know, there's a completely like media scholarly theory behind my unhealthy habit of spicing up my Twitter feed often inadvisedly.
So it's an experiment. Are you experimenting on us?
let's say that. Yeah. It's a live participatory transmedia exercise.
Oh, big guns.
You're right. So yeah, just throw bigger words at it so that it sounds legitimate, like the metaverse.
You said something really interestingly, and that was you know, we have this second self, and it's really interesting to try to dig into that. Now, something I'm really interested in is the fact that we do have these multiple selves that we project in different arenas. In the anthropology world, we actually have, you know, terms and theories for this phenomenon. One of them is called the figured worlds theory. Wow. And that's, you know, I'll give a quick crash course. And that's basically...
I love this anthropology context
yeah,
for this.
Let's get real naughty here. My favorite. Basically... every different social space is referred to as a figured world. And so, like, that can be the supermarket or your home or, you know, in a group outing with a certain group of people, multiple different groups of friends will be different figured worlds. So essentially, it's like different social makeups, and they will change according to, like, the different people and social dynamics involved in their spaces. And so as one person moves through multiple figured worlds, you'll find that they begin, like, projecting different parts of their personality to fit the dynamic of that particular figured world. So you'll actually find somebody can act very differently across different spaces, but it doesn't mean they're, like, necessarily being different people or being fake or whatever. They're just... you know, they're adapting to the social expectations and social dynamics of a particular environment. So, like, the question kind of becomes, as we have these multiple selves, like, what is real? What is authentic? Like, where are we drawing these boundaries? Are we considering, you know, like, if we're going to go really binary and say we have kind of, like, this authentic self and this, like, inauthentic or, like, a dramatized self. I'm really interested in the question, is that the one we present more in the real, like, meat space world, or are we maybe more authentic when we're online and, like, hidden behind our screens and our keyboards? What do you think?
Or, like, you know, is authenticity contextual? So that the questions that you're asking are, like, the very thesis. I'm trying to do a speculative fiction novel about this very notion of performance of self in different sort of media layers and where we find authenticity, especially, like, when it's all content under capitalism and so forth. So that's just, like, that's, like, a singular obsession for me right now. I want to throw a question back to you both, actually. So have you ever role played on the internet before?
Oh,
I had an internet role play character. Yes,
many. That is my life, dude.
Me too.
Like, real and fake. Like, sometimes they know I'm role playing, and sometimes they don't. I went undercover on adult webcam sites because I wanted to discover what fetishes, like, really were. So, you know, I went. Like, this is before I got my anthropology degree, et cetera.
A lot of, like, dressing up your internet self to enter communities where otherwise maybe we would have been too young to be accepted there. So you pretend to be
Absolutely.
Someone else.
Oh, God.
You don't want anyone to know what your gender is, so you obscure it. I had, like, I had my fictional characters, and then I had my, like, fictional real characters. Like, yeah, there's several layers of the types of performance that we can do and that we've always been able to do. I just think, you know, what's really exciting, you know, both of us are also involved in game design and stuff. And something that's exciting for me is that, you know, this character design is becoming very immediate thanks to social media. And, like, what we used to have to kind of log into a video game world to go and do, you know, it's kind of like watching people's larger than life character performances unfolding on social media is kind of like the new the new storytelling form of the century we're in. And I think, like, you know, we used to have to dig tunnel deep into the internet dungeons to find out all the role play drama and the FF7 houses and all of that. But now it's like everyone's got a weird story. And everyone's got a place to perform. I'm finding it really, it's an interesting climate.
We used to have to be labeled as sociopaths in order to do what everyone is now readily doing on a daily basis. So like I remember about 20 years ago or no, 25 years ago, I was in Los Angeles and I was with a friend of mine and we were like my writing partner, Ethan at the time. And we were writing the script together and we were rather inebriated. And at some point it was like ABC News or something. And there was these two twins, they tend to be two, but there were these twins called Lynx and Lamb, who are these white supremacist
girls
with little smiley Hitler t-shirts.
Yeah, I've seen them.
And we saw them on TV and we're like, dude, this is so messed up. Let's send them fan mail. And so we decided to pretend to be this woman called Eva Schickelgruber, who, of course, that was the real name of Adolf Hitler, of course, which these idiots probably wouldn't realize, we thought.
Right.
And so we pretended to be these neo-Nazis in order to try and see how these people are thinking. And on the way to actually help my friend Ethan's mom move from Seattle, we stopped by that town, Bakersfield, California, which is eerily close to San Francisco, one of the most liberal towns, so to speak, on Earth, to find this place which is where the Walmart is literally entirely staffed by Nazis. So it's almost like walking into a sort of alternate reality RPG. You walk into this town and the whole town is a video game. It's like all the rules are different. The sort of behavior between characters and humans is an alternate reality. And so I guess being the sort of, you know, story and meaning seeking sociopaths that I am, that was an interesting experiment. But I realized that we're all kind of doing that now. You know, all of society is fitting into some sort of other alternate reality, other category, other community, sometimes ones that are far removed from themselves, just to find meaning somewhere.
Well, I think we're exposed to so much information that we can find a pattern to validate anything we want to believe and then even to extremize what it is we want to believe. And I think because we've been dissociated from community and dissociated from ecology, we're trying to use the technology environment to make sense of ourselves and where we belong. And that's just that sort of dissection of our self-concept across these, like, you know, now that's why we have people going into these like conspiracy theory brain worms, because there's a fragmentation, like the ordinary integrity of a self doesn't like hold in this kind of environment, I think. But I think, you know, it's interesting that you call it like sociopathy, right? Because there's been this notion of the 90s, like, remember, all we wanted to do was look at horrible things online and look at murders and like expose ourselves to grotesquery because we were soulless and nihilistic and supposed. But, you know, the longer I'm spending in the media environment, I think it's like the people who were drawn to these types of activities are, you know, some of my most sensitive friends. And like, you know, I personally think I'm such a sensitive person that I have trouble coping in life. And so like, I'm wondering like, you know, this, and obviously like, you know, whether the performance of another person is ethical or not, or whether the, you know, deception online, you know, like these types of things can be viewed as sociopathic from one lens, and then performances of empathy and closeness and similarity from another. Like, you know, inhabiting someone's space is how you get to know who they are. Being curious about viewing the world from different points of view. I mean, I think that's a lot of like what playing games is about, you know, sort of changing your orientation to various problems from outside what it normally would be. And so it's like, you know, I do think, you know, maybe the underlying drive is empathy, and the underlying drive is the desire to find community and to be part of something bigger than yourself. But, you know, there's a broken information climate that's sort of, I think, corroding this instinct of ours.
I think imitation being an act of flattery is true, and flattery is a form of empathy when you want someone else to feel good and you actually want to honor them through imitating them, or perhaps trying to fit in some way, even if you're doing it sarcastically, as I did in our case 25 years ago. But there's the other flip side to it when marginalized people, women, for instance, over many, many centuries have been forced into certain roles and a certain character types and certain behaviors that they didn't necessarily, and for the most part, didn't want to inhabit or embody. And that's also an interesting part, the fact that we have to perform as something that we're, oh, the obedient little housewife, the whatever other bloody character people are expected to be. And that's an interesting flip side as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I agree. I think, you know, early in my games career, there weren't a lot, I didn't know a lot of, or rather all the other women that were working in games journalism at the time, it felt like at least that we knew each other. And I didn't really feel like, you know, there were other women like me there. And like, you know, what I did instead was like, look at the examples there were and try to perform like that. You know, like, you only conceive of yourself, you only conceive for yourself of what is available among the roles that you see. And so I think, like, you know, we're increasing the visibility of all different kinds of roles. We're increasing the visibility of what it's possible to be. And I think, in a way, you know, you can't understand what you can't visualize, and you can't achieve what you can't first, you know, verbalize and visualize for yourself. And so I think, I don't know, some of this role diversity is probably good. You know, mm-hmm. I think obviously when we're talking about, you know, we're also talking about we're talking about a world where individuals commit acts of disinformation on a daily basis. We misrepresent ourselves and we make the people in our social network think things. And, you know, we try to elevate the viewpoints that we agree with and suppress the ones that we don't. We all do it. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. It's like, you know, we're living in a society of performative disinformation. And I think there's both opportunities and like really scary things about that.
Chantal?
Yeah, I was just thinking, and it's very kind of interesting to touch on this mimetic nature of humanity, because like that is really core and fundamental to who we are. If you look at children and babies, we learn every behavior we have, essentially. There are studies done on babies where, like, you know, if a baby is smiled at, they will learn to smile far, far younger. And I can get very deep here when we start to talk about language and things like that, and the fact that levels of kind of measurable intelligence can be linked to language that needs to be mimicked by young children, which needs to be modeled by older people. And yeah, you can just like, you can trace all of this back to the fact that most animals, not all animals, but most animals are essentially like mimetic beings. And we do learn to be who we are by mimicking the examples that have come before us, by learning what it is people do to survive. And that's essentially, you know, it's how we come to culture. Culture is essentially a pattern of mimicry that emerges and begins to like represent and recreate itself time and time again. It becomes tradition, it becomes expectation, etc. So yeah, we have these really kind of interesting overlaps with culture, and that intersects with this joy of representation that you guys have touched on here, which is Lee, you know, you said something really interesting there about you can only kind of be who you have examples to be, but you can kind of like take multiple examples and begin to mold an original identity out of that for yourself. So the more kind of like wider spectrum we have,
the bigger corpus we have, the more diverse identities can be generated from the miasma.
Here we go. Let's go with the proc gen talk. I'm ready for it. But yeah, it is so important to have that wide spectrum. And that is like what, you know, we and like people who have come before us have been pushing for, is a diversity of representation, not just for, you know, like existing groups, but for the people who are going to come after us. Like, we can only think wider if we like live wider.
But what's interesting to me is this idea of performance and also a performative identity. Because that's essentially all I do. I mean, I sort of write things for other people to perform identities that I'm either, and characters that I'm inventing and sort of forging for them and with them. And at the same time, you know, the internet has become a place where, of course, lots of predators dominate it and poison it. And so there's a faction of people that want to push for people only using their real names online, as opposed to nicknames. There's also, and a lot of it coming from the left as well, actors are no longer allowed to perform as genders or sexual orientations that they're not in real life. Which is also interesting. So we have these sort of poles pulling from all directions. Like, do we have to entirely be ourselves? Is there such a thing as ourselves? Why not? Is it not an empathic thing to actually try and embody someone that you're not? Is it always offensive when you do? We're torn by this, aren't we, right now as a society and as entertainers as well?
Yeah, it is a huge struggle, particularly, I think, for writers. I might just be saying this as a writer myself who suddenly finds that, I've always tried to be someone who has a kind of diversity of characters and perspectives, etc., which inevitably is going to include perspectives of people I am not, because you can't realistically write stories about 10 different versions of you. I don't think that makes for interesting writing. And so we do come into this kind of interesting conundrum of all of a sudden we are, trying to represent sort of a worldview or a representation of being of these identities that we have never lived. There is kind of a very an ethically responsible call to make sure that we are authentically and fairly and responsibly representing people we are writing or attempting to embody. But it does beg the question, how practical or realistic or even fair is it to expect creators to kind of fully engage with accurate representation of every character they are trying to kind of fictionalize?
The thing I feel gets lost is that character is far from the only place where, representation can be expressed and where authenticity can be expressed. I think, because we're living in this sort of post-real society, we want one-to-one realism. We want the representation and the reality to be close. We're not really tolerating that gap anymore because that dissonance is all around us. But I do think it's possible, to achieve, first of all, I tend to think that all art is versions of ourselves fundamentally, and again, maybe that's not expressed through character, but everything we make is an expression of ourselves and our desires and our beliefs in the world that we want to see and who with, consciously or otherwise. I really enjoy analyzing my own and others' work for subconscious themes. I find in the making of I'm just going on a brief tangent now. I find that in a lot of major AAA video games, the narrative structure seems to tell the story of its making. Metal Gear Solid 5 being about going rogue and having a huge unfinished base. that's a simple example, but I think that type of thing happens a lot. And, I think it's good that we're in a creative time when we're paying more attention to authenticity. I think where the problem is that we're considering this entirely from an identity-driven and character-focused perspective, which is a very self-focused, ego-focused perspective. You know what I mean? And I think again, when we're thinking about representation or the story of a culture or a story of a person or a place, diversity can mean, different writers. Diversity can mean someone else behind the lens, someone else's aesthetic sensibility. You know what I mean? It's a very limiting definition of representation to say it's about what characters we can do, because I think, there's a lot of other ways to express oneself in art besides representing themselves through a character. And maybe our focus on representing themselves representing ourselves as characters is part of this media climate that we're talking about. But authenticity is something that is contextual too.
Yeah, it's really interesting how we have corporations, such as, for instance, Disney, usurping this idea of authenticity and, you know, the sort of truthful representation of a certain culture.
Yeah, they'll sell you whatever color character you want.
they will, absolutely. Yeah. And I won't necessarily or directly say who it was, but it was one of the creators of Black Panther. We had a meeting with in LA over 2 decades ago, and I had a meeting in a room with, and Jaimin Hunsu was in the room with me on a film that we were sort of working on together, and that particular Marvel associated character person had a meeting with us talking about the script that we were that I'd written, and Jaimin had to leave. He had to have a meeting with Ridley Scott, so he had to dash off. And that particular Marvel person said to me, "Oh, he was lovely, the little black boy." And I said to myself, like, "Wow, fuck." I mean, Jaimin Hunsu is, I think, 6'4" or 6'5".
No.
I mean, his hands are larger than my head. I mean, so little he's not. Certainly not a boy either, because he was already always older than me. So one can't but help think. One can't help but think that perhaps that person was not the right guy to create Black Panther. You know what I mean?
Doesn't it often work this way? That, you know, a lot of the people, you know, the quote unquote feminist movies and the quote unquote black movies have, like, you know, a group of old white guys behind it, pulling all the strings, making all the decisions. You know, again, it just shows that, you know, representation is only kind of part of it. It's who's, you know, is the person producing the film respecting the experiences of the people, or is it the result of market research? You know, it's just the lens that that you bring to the work matters so much. And I think, you know, a lot of times we find the most problematic people doing the most virtue signaling work because they're smoke screening for what their actual beliefs are.
Of course, they're hiding. They're hiding behind that identity, and that's their puppet that they inhabit. And it's interesting because, I mean, we've got these brands or these branded universes that are now dominating our landscape. They were created by a bunch of old white men, and mostly in the 60s and 70s. A lot of them also as a response to far more liberal, far more free movements at the time that they were probably responding to with their fascistic superhero characters. And now they're the dominant force. And on top of that fascistic intent that those characters had, and you'd only have to read, you know, listen to what Alan Moore has to say about the topic. And I think he has a thing or two to say about it because he's partly responsible for creating this world that we're all inhabiting now of branded cinematic, whatever the hell, universes that only speak one language on top of that, which is hilarious, which is English. What a very reductive universe that is. But yeah, I mean, he warned people against it. I've created a monster. I helped create a monster. We are now projecting ethics and intent onto something that had none, other than, you know, whatever it had. I don't know. So that's another interesting identity, the identity that brands and Hollywood and game companies pretend to embrace issues while also at the same time saying, hey, we're not political. We have no identity. But here's some identities for you.
No, I think that paradox of superheroes in, you know, for example, U.S. culture right now and in the media climate, I think that in itself is, I think it tells on itself. You know what I mean? It's about what you said, what you just said it's about. And whether it's aware of that subtext or not, that is what it's about.
Sarah, we are on the topic of identity. Lee, you mentioned that you are currently working on something that is trying to essentially get at the heart of kind of like what identity is. Can you tell us anything more about that?
Oh my God. Well, you made it sound quite ambitious. I'm trying to write a speculative fiction novel called The Plant, and it is about, I'm using sort of the structure of an accessible thriller, you know, where everyone's suspicious and the assignation of blame is constantly being revealed.
Because
I think we're doing so much of that sleuthing work and, you know, that sleuthing, I think thrillers are so popular right now because, you know, our bullshit detectors have to be so acute in these times. and we are really interested in stories about credibility and how we assess credibility. And I think the social media climate sort of adds a fourth dimension to that usual puzzle, you know, about whether you know who you're talking to. And so there's like a bit of a sort of surrealist bit to it as well. It's like, you know, if you, you know, what does it require to invent a person, you know, and you know, how do you know who online is real? How do you know who is a character? You know, and what are the definitions of those terms can change depending on the context you are in. So it's basically kind of it's like a romantic thriller about this woman who's recovering from internet trauma when suddenly she encounters, apparently, her role play character, which she thought she made up, like online in the real world. And it's about her trying to get to the bottom of who that person is as these various influencer murders are occurring around her. And it's set in a utopian, like sort of post-futurist community on a reclaimed automobile manufacturing plant. So she's sort of living this like immersive real world fantasy of like, put your devices down and rely on your community. But she's literally haunted by, you know, this incident from her past and her desire to meet this character in her future.
And can't quite put the screens away ever.
Exactly. Yeah. So she comes into conflict with, you know, reality editors and marketers and you know, her own notion of reality, and yeah, so it's kind of ambitious, and I'm not, you know, I've only done short stories before, so this is like something that is really important to me, that I've been working on a lot. But like, these are like, I'm doing this book because these are the ideas that are important to me in all, everything that I work on right now. Like my little hobby project that I'm making with Brian Bucklew is like a Macintosh graphics McMansion celebrity murder, like Big Brother McMansion celebrity murder simulator game. Yes. And this I'm trying is also to use about like to use to comment on the junction of celebrity and performance. I'm just rambling on now because I'm just really excited about this stuff. No one has asked me about it in a long time.
Dude, I look, after this I'm gonna be asking you so many more questions, so be prepared for that. Yeah, we have a very kind of big overlap in our special interests and also
special interests, yeah,
our special interests of influencer culture and identity formation and like, you know, how, like, what are we doing to ourselves, and is it good, is it bad, is it natural, is it like, what is unnatural? Yeah, very interesting concepts. And we're also working on kind of very similar projects in ways.
I would love to hear more about yours as well.
There's a lawsuit. There's a plagiarism lawsuit brewing here. This is where it kicks off. These two people here have been making the same project.
Oh, no. I think we like genre, we like post-gen, we like black and white aesthetics.
We
like the metaphorical notion of a dungeon in digital space.
We could drill down, and our drill is going to like collide and explode, and it's going to be beautiful.
Of course, it's a total coincidence that I would have invited you both to be talking together.
I know. Good job on the curation. I think curation is the most important skill of the 21st century, and you have represented that.
Kick it to Yag. He's got that Cupid bow and arrow just like sitting there in his corner, like, I'm gonna put these people together. It's exciting to, you know, like, this is why we do what we do, or at least partly. I think, you know, part of being a creative is to get our ideas out into the world and to like essentially convince people of them. You know, we want people to see the way we see it and to connect and to understand why we feel the way that we feel. I mentioned in episode 0, there's a wonderful quote that I quote all the time that I'm gonna keep quoting, and it's by Kazuo Ishiguro. In his Nobel Literature Prize acceptance speech, and he says, in the end, stories are about one person saying to another, this is the way it feels to me. Can you understand what I'm saying? does it feel this way to you? And, you know, like, I think being an artist is really, it's all about that. It's getting this kind of like weird validation. And, you know, like trying to convince on the way, like, you know, maybe you didn't start out agreeing, but maybe once I make you engage with the logic and the experience and perspective of how I came to feel the way I feel about these things, maybe it will feel this way for you. So that's one part of it. But I think the other is just like a little bit of loneliness and being like, oh, I have all these feelings in the world and I'm going to put myself out there and I'm going to be able to connect with other people who like can connect back with me on these things, I guess, so much about. And that's why doing stuff like this is really exciting, because we get to find people with big and beautiful hearts who have kind of these big, exciting ideas and ambitions. And we all get to like sit around and nut out for a little bit.
It feels really, really, really great to talk to people who are going places and who have come from places and have fought their way through quite a lot of shit to get where they are today, and also want to influence the, yeah, for lack of a better word, direction that people have in the future as well. Like, I think it's one thing to talk about one's feelings because they are the thing that don't necessarily drive us, but they're the thing that underlie everything that we do and that we try to do something about as well. But it's also the idea of trying to reach out to people and have a debate, have a conversation, isn't it? It's not just here's who I am, here's what I feel, but also, what do we do about this feeling? Do you feel that there's a thing that drives you as well a little bit? What do we do with this now?
Well, I think, you know, Chantal talked about, you know, the mirroring that we do for infants and children to culturally reinforce, you know, things to one another, and how that's a sort of a holistic loop of growth that human beings have. And, you know, I think, you know, by making art, we want to be part of this loop. We want to have our turn to hold the mirror, you know, and I think that feels as valuable to me as, like, you know, as having children is, you know, joining the loop of ideas in some way. And everything, you know, sort of that I've experienced was because I was, you know, I really cared about the areas that I was working in. And I was committed to moving that conversation forward. It's a compulsion. You know, it's like, I really didn't choose it at all. And if I had had any rational sense, I wouldn't have chosen this course. But, you know, it's a compulsion to communicate about these things. It's a compulsion to turn that passion into language and hopefully even experience. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, I think it does. I think I've been accused multiple times of like loving to hear, like loving the sound of my own voice. That's the one.
Oh, really?
I hear that, yep, one too.
And it's like, I don't hate the sound of my own voice. Thankfully, I don't have to listen to it when it comes out of me. But there's other people's problem. But but I'm actually, I love other people telling me to shut up by saying beautiful things. Like, that's, and the only way I can encourage that to happen is by talking to them. And that is the thing that I enjoy. I enjoy hearing from people that have stuff to say that makes my brain go into, you know, fireworks. And that's stunning to me. I cannot stand the status quo, and I cannot stand repetition. I cannot stand routine. And when it happens, and when it happens in society, it's death. Yes.
So you want to destroy the mimetic process. You want new.
I want new because the old shit has been keeping us down for so long. And I think that's the one thing that the idiots that call cancel culture. Mm-hmm. It's like, first of all, it's canceling nothing. And second of all, the idea of telling assholes that it's just not tolerated to be one
Yeah. What is our other avenues for social response in these times? Like we're losing our ability to connect with one another as a community and to set our norms collectively. So this like this mass behavior is sometimes the only way we have to express ourselves.
It's the only way, and but it's culture.
Yeah, like historically, social ostracization goes, you know, back to the dawn of humanity. We simply used to exile people outside kind of the village walls.
Yeah.
In the age of the internet, there are no walls really beyond the mute button or beyond the block button.
And then after like you got exiled from the village walls, you couldn't still win comedy prizes.
Exactly. You would just be eaten by wolves or starve to death or, like, you know, get horrible infections and die alone. It's, you know, today we have a pretty good trade-off. You are shut up on the internet, but you can continue your merry old life everywhere else.
Yeah, you can just buy Parler.
Not much of a cancel.
Yeah.
And you know, the people who decry cancel culture so much are never concerned about when it's marginalized people being unjustly harassed about their platforms for their bodies and their choices until they fear for their personal safety. Like, you know, why is that not cancel culture when women are hounded out of their jobs or you know, people are hounded out of their careers because they did sex work or things like that?
And like, really, we complain so much less. Like, we really do, because we're so used to it. You know, like, it's like, this is, I just
I've been on the internet
that
since
way.
I was a kid.
Exactly. It's like, oh, people are threatening to, like, you know, sexually assault and murder me. Like, that's a Tuesday. Like, have you been a woman playing video games on the internet? That is, like, that's life.
It's a sign
Why
of affection
would they
in some forms, in fact.
Exactly.
I mean, men have been literally failing their way up for fucking centuries. And they continue doing that all the time. And so when, for instance, in our entertainment industry, if a man makes a flop, then he's just making perhaps a slightly smaller movie or a slightly slightly smaller game the next time. When a woman fails, like, it'll take another 10 years.
They never let
her forget it, yeah. It won't be forgotten.
She can't make something saleable. My God.
That's what men say. It's not cancel culture. It's capitalism. It's
It's reality.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's a meritocracy. It's what this is.
Sweet Lord, baby Jesus. That's about all I have to respond to that. Yeah, it's an interesting society we live in. So, I don't know. You know, we talk about on this podcast, we want to talk about ideas and particularly rebellious ideas. I haven't even really nailed down what a rebellious idea means, other than that it makes you think about things that you're not used to thinking about, and maybe certain stakeholders don't want you to think about, because that becomes problematic. So, you know, that's all well and good, but the most important question, as Yark has brought up, is like, what do we do about it? Why do we put all this work into making the things we make, you know, like, people, I don't want to say like us, but maybe people like us, you know, like maybe people like Lee, who has the spicy tweets and says the spicy things and, you know, engages with questions that people aren't engaging with that are actually really important to be engaged with. Like, you called it a compulsion, and it absolutely is, Lee, but like, what drives us?
I think I have trouble judging social cues, and I don't understand the taboo against certain types of community. Like, you know, I honestly, there's like a limit. There's actually like an impediment to my socialization that causes me to be this way. You know, that causes me to be interested in closed loops that I can solve, or in generative bodies where I know the corpus. Like, you know what I mean? You know, I think, you know, in addition to expressing ourselves, we're trying to control an uncontrollable world. And what I, you know, I can only control how I treat my fellow person and how I express myself in the environment. And I can try to do that to the best of my ability. And like, I've decided, like, I've become so structurally overwhelmed and so information overloaded and so tired of structural thinking about many things that I've tried to focus on a one-on-one correlation. And, you know, my work is structural, obviously, like everything I want to do comments on systems. But I think I used to have this idea when I was doing games journalism that, you know, the writing that that I and other people were doing was sort of part of this like groundswell that was going to finally mainstream our understanding of games and make people finally respect us as artists. And, you know, I fell into all the traps that we are cyclically go through now, like, oh, once we have our New York Times article, then we'll have made it. Or, you know, once we work with a famous director, then we'll have made it. And none of these things have made it for us. And eventually, you know, I kind of had to accept that maybe it is what it is enough, and I can take care of my little corner of it. You know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. you know, just for many of us, the act of even just being in the space is transformative. And, you know, I don't want to be asked to do any more for media than I have. You know, like,
yeah,
what can we do? I take care of my own little patch of it. And I try to express the things that I care about through systemic work and systemic art. But I mean, that's not to say I don't feel like socially responsible. I'm very like, I feel like I'm maybe hypervigilant in my creation about the things like representation, or, you know, I do feel like, you know, a responsibility to like have an ethical creative platform. And you know, I am sort of self-moderating in that way, I guess, because there's certain values that to which contributing to them means something to me. But yeah, other than that, that's the best answer I've got for you.
I love that.
That's a good one.
I thought that was brilliant. I years ago, after my dad passed away and things seemed quite sort of confusing and sort of almost for futile in many things, because I'd felt that all the things that I'd always been telling my dad, my parents for that matter, were both gone now, I wanted to achieve. I felt like I was lagging at least that that's where hope comes in, but at least 15, 20 years behind my original estimates. And I think that had a big effect on me. Well, I know it did, but at some point I was just sort of struggling with all that. And I went to a therapist who finally sort of boiled down all my sort of my feelings of wanting to fight things and wanting to be that sort of David versus that impossible Goliath of politicians and society and the entertainment industry and all that jazz. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, I think I figured it out. I think your circle of concern is far bigger than your circle of influence. And once you take that on board, once you really just embrace that, you'll be cool. That doesn't mean you're going to stop fighting. Doesn't mean you're going to start giving a shit. It just means you will be able to relax into the little things that you can do in order to affect the life around you meaningfully. And that was gorgeous. And the other thing that I've realized, you're right. Was when I was writing, because I started out as a game journalist as well, was studying theater in New York. And
I studied theater in New York.
Oh my God. Where?
American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
I was at the Tisch School of the Arts and the Stella Adler Conservatory at NYU. Yeah.
Are you enemies? Is this like a rivalry thing going on?
I wasn't good enough in school to be like that.
Yeah. No, Lee's actually my nemesis.
Yeah. But, you fucks.
Yeah, it was me all along, Lee.
we did dance battles all down the road at each other. Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but yeah, similar background. It's so great that we have so much in common. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, and there will be much more to come. But the funny thing was, the interesting thing was, I had the same aspirations in the sense that I wanted to elevate games because I knew that their potential was growing into something, and yes. I wanted to grow with it. And also my interests beyond games were so profoundly into literature and cinema and music and theater and all those things. Oh my God, this is going to be the ultimate art form. This is going to be the cultural art form of the future. And sure, it hasn't achieved that, and a lot of it is bullshit, and yes, possibly the majority of it is. And but if talking about directions, at least it's going up. Like there is that there is within the ghetto of indie games with meaning, at least that one is growing, like it's expanding. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the film world, which, you know, was always on the highest pedestal culturally, at least in last century anyway, as the sort of ultimate form in which all of the different forms come together into this like thing that is celebrated at festivals with celebrities and red carpets and yachts. That industry is now on the way down and is being replaced by branded entertainment, which itself is mimicking video game aesthetics and also video game narrative, which is for the most part inferior. So, and therefore losing itself. So don't you think that perhaps we don't have a choice? Like if we are people that are driven by hope and meaning and intent and all those things, then to fight within the arena of games and its and their potential, because that's where the future is.
Yeah, like ironically after, oh, sorry, Chantel, would you like to speak?
No, I'm very curious to hear what you're about to say.
Well, I just got nervous and forgot, I think. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, even though I just made this whole speech about, you know, how I think we should sort of give up on this idea of games making it in the sense of having this wider cultural validation. On the other hand, I think we're closer than maybe perhaps we're ahead of our time. And we are just now beginning to enter an area that is suitable for games designers to be cross-platform storytellers. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think we're in a culture now where we participate live in all the stories that we enjoy. Mm-hmm. You know, combine that with the desire to identify and perform as characters. I think, and our 24/7 social media culture and streaming television events, I think it is a climate where the pieces are there for games to sort of transcend the home console and private platform environment and become something that is more culturally omnipresent. Like, you know, Among Us is basically something, you know, like that, you know, that it became such a huge event that you had YouTubers performing Among Us in real life in their YouTuber McMansions. And, you know, you had people.
My 8-year-old plays Among Us games at school. Like, that's a game that they play.
Yeah, and like the cultural penetration like this, and it's a hit and roll game, which is like a lot of popular game shows like The Mole. And so, you know, we're having social mechanics of game shows that are being part of live streamed games that people watch and people perform. And I think, you know, I'd like to believe that that's going to keep happening and that there's going to be the opportunity for people like us who care about these things and who view interactive storytelling in such a holistic way. I hope there will be more opportunities to do the kind of work that, you know, that we would be proud of.
Yeah, I mean, we're working on a film right now called A Winter's Journey based on Schubert's Winterreise, his song cycle, with John Malkovich and a bunch of other people in the leading roles. And the film was shot in live action and the environments have been built using dreams. So we've been working with Media Molecule on that. And so Sony Pictures Classics will be distributing the film, but PlayStation's logo will be on it as well.
And that's cool.
And it's an art house film with no words. There's no dialogue. And it's 24 songs told in 24 continuous shots, which is only made possible through immersive media or through, you know, 3D graphics, which in this case were provided and designed in dreams. So, for instance, as people of mixed cultures, mixed races, mixed backgrounds, mixed interests, we are sort of, we have trans identities that aren't locked into one nationality, one media for that part either. And I think it's exciting that at a time when finally the voices of the marginalized and the unusual are starting to become or are demanding to be normalized, that the same is also happening in the media industries. Movies as on their own are no longer going to be worth making. Like they have to become an event. Games on their own as just an interactive thing on a screen are no longer relevant. They have to create waves beyond the screen. I think if they are to make a difference, if they are to resonate, and you both are rare animals in this world who who embrace this fully? Because, and is it maybe because you weren't left a choice in the matter? Because we had a bit of a conversation about that with you, Lee, at some point, where I asked you, like, why do you make things that are political and all those things? And then you said, well, they didn't. And you said something about, you know, you really and you like genre and mainstream things, but yes. But you weren't necessary. I'll let you elaborate. You know where I'm going with it.
Yeah, I basically said that, you know, my work is seen as political because my very existence in this space is thought to be political. And even just talking about my experiences in a space that's hostile to my existence becomes a political act in a way that it's not for people who are not marginalized in a given space. So I think, like, you know, the work of people of color or the work of queer people is seen as inherently political because it's work that's coming from people whose right to be there is inherently under debate. And so the conversation we had was that, you know, whether for our work to be political is a designation that's imposed on us rather than something that we choose necessarily. Like, and obviously there are people whose work is conscientiously political. And, you know, I've certainly, you know, tried to do, you know, explicitly feminist stuff with various degrees of success because, you know, that's something I believe in. But, you know, whose existence creatively is political is an interesting question. I'm going to let Chantal speak because I feel like I've been coming in a lot.
No, I mean, I don't really have much to add to that. I think particular people's existences are fundamentally going to, you know, be more political. I don't think be more political is necessarily the right description. It is, you're forced into political spaces by, you know, needing to fight more for certain rights, certain representation in order to have like a level of being safeguarded in society where, you know, people whose identities fall more within like the dominant status quo aren't going to need to, you know, like have such strong pushes and need so much active vocalization over needing certain things met. So yeah, like we, you know, you and I, Lee in particular, I know like we fit across various spaces of marginalized identities. So we're gonna inherently be banging into questions more often that are gonna mean a lot to us over, like, you know, what does it mean to be a woman in a patriarchal society, or what does it mean to be a non-white person in a white-dominated society, or what does it mean? I do not know your sexual orientation, but for me, you know, it's like, what does it mean to be queer or to be like, you know, very like fluid around certain things that are usually not fluid at all. Mm-hmm. And like you're forced to answer, like ask and answer these questions for yourself. And that is kind of like the work of the creative, to learn about these differences within yourself and to kind of like coax it out. And like, I think that, at least for me, that is so much of my creative work, is it's really a process of self-discovery. And that is what makes it political, is because it's kind of like by existing, it is pressing against the status quo. And then that forces questions of like, okay, but why? Or, but what does it mean to be against the status quo?
Yeah. What aspect is it of me that people are responding negatively to? Yes, or like, you know, what shape would they prefer that I be?
Exactly. And that, I mean, it is really interesting that you and I have kind of like gone into this hyper-focus on questions of identity. As an anthropologist, I specialized in identity and personhood. And it was very literally those questions. It's like, what does it mean to be a person? What does it, like, what is an identity? Like, how do we formulate an identity? Like, what various aspects.
What topics would be me? What environmental triggers caused the shape of me to originate?
Yeah, and what is a shape? Where are we drawing these boundaries? And how are other people drawing these boundaries? And where are these differences beginning and ending?
It's interesting. I as a kid was affected in a different way, obviously, very different way. But I was born in Belgium, son of a German and of a Pole, two characters or two nationalities that just a few decades beforehand, and certainly a couple of decades before they met, were still at war, at a bit of war.
Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. And they met in Turkey, of all places. But when I was born, I was branded by passport German in Belgium because my father worked for the European Union. And so he could choose. So I wasn't a Belgian, even though I was born on that soil against my own will, probably. Everyone is born against their own will, wherever they end up. So I didn't have one yet. And then I also had access to a Polish identity. And then people have all my life, literally every day I get asked where I'm from. And I have no idea. I mean, I just genuinely have no idea what to answer that question because I don't identify with Belgium. I don't really identify with Germany at all. I couldn't live there. I was just in Cologne at Gamescom. I was pissed off after 2 hours there. I couldn't ever live in Germany. You know, Poland.
He really was.
I love the Polish sense of humor and fighting spirit. I find the country completely unfathomable at the moment politically, and I just cannot even think about it. I'm in the UK, which is probably the biggest political shit show in Europe at the moment. And here I am, forced to have a British passport because of Brexit. And at the same time, the same shit has been happening to me on creatively and professionally all my life. I've always had to be either a director or a writer, or I had to make games or movies. How you can't make both and all that stuff. So for me, my obsession has been with branding, the idea of being branded with something, the fact of having a sort of certain logo imposed on you, whether it's on a stamp on a passport or a fucking corporation telling you how to behave and what to do, what kind of content you're expected to make for them and for their dumbass platforms. And so that's been my work. I guess more of an externalized thing, rather than personal identity. It's more of the imposed sort of larger umbrella under which we're all supposed to behave. I mean, to take you back to that those white supremacist twins who then, by the way, left that whole community, so to speak, behind, and one of them started dating an African American, but which is a happy ending to that story. But when we decided to go to Bakersfield and check out that bullshit.
Look at Lee's face.
I was like, is it happy? I wonder if it's happy for her husband or if that's the plot of a horror movie that I've seen before.
I have no idea. I mean, at least it shows that she wasn't.
With so much childhood racial trauma to start dating a black man, that just must be a very interesting relationship to his family.
Oh my God, I have no idea. Happy in the sense that she at least left the community behind.
I know. Obviously, we want to believe that white supremacy is something that people can recover from and that they can change their beliefs and stuff. But I mean, I don't know. I hope that guy's doing okay.
That is another podcast episode.
As I arrived in Bakersfield with my friend, there was this literally a road sign there saying, "Welcome to Bakersfield." And not that people speak like that. And there was this road sign, and there were a bunch of cows in the field. And this was pre-selfies, but we were way ahead of our time. So we took a photo of ourselves, holding this fucking camera and hoping that it would click the right, capture at least half our faces. And then we looked into the field, and there were cows branded with swastikas.
The fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't know why I'm going there, because we were talking about brands, indeed, and logos, and this bullshit imposition of those things on everything.
Yeah, sometimes there's a lot of involuntary encounters with symbolism.
Yes, there was then.
That. We consent in the branded environment is dubious, we can conclude.
Yes. So we have external identities imposed on us by bigger, they're sort of these concoctions by corporations and by money and greed and power. And there's our own personal ones and the fight that we have to either conform or rebel, and sometimes all at the same time. And that's what we make.
People make different decisions, and that is, you know, that's a whole other thing to explore, and is really very interesting.
Have we solved anything?
I mean, I've had a really good time. I feel like it's kind of like a prank that anyone, like, this is usually the type of stuff that I'd like to go on about in bars and then people walk away from me. So the fact that we're able to actually record this has been a real lark for me. I love this topic.
And I'm like, let me trap you in a bar shortly. Let's do it.
All right, I'm in.
Let's do the nerd thing.
We'll do it.
Lee, earlier you said that, you know, you guys, you did the New York Times thing, you did the director thing, nothing really worked with, like, making those inroads. But then later you said maybe we were ahead of our time because, you know, the time is now. But I'm, you know, when you said that, I was like, I didn't want to interrupt, but I thought maybe, you know, it was you and the youth of the world who made those inroads, who carved out spaces for it to be the way it is now. And, you know, like, so much of the work is groundwork. It is laying the groundwork. It is kind of, you know, when there's a jar and it just, the lid weren't open, and you pass it to someone and they don't open the lid, but then they pass it back and all of a sudden you can open the jar and it's like, oh, you loosened it.
I do think, like, you know, games in particular have such a weirdly cyclical memory, and we repeat the same conversations about, you know, across generations. And one thing I would say would be that, like, yeah, maybe our generation of game designers is thinking about the virtual self and embodiments in virtual space before anyone else. But then I realize there's a generation of designers older than me who were writing books on, like, teledildonics and the metaverse and all of this since the 70s. So there is, like, you know, the earliest groundswells of scholarship on games, I do think, are maybe a blueprint for the future of media. And maybe, you know, we did get our chance to hold and pull on the jar a little bit during our time, and hopefully maybe we could pull it a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, that's human nature right there. Like, that is all of human history, is building on the work of the people who have come before us, sometimes for good and sometimes for evil. But that is what we do.
I think we've solved everything.
Yeah. Yes. High score achieved, people.
We have saved the world. We have saved video games from themselves.
Yeah.
It's all done. We can go home. Congratulations.
Well done, all.
Well, Lee, thank you for coming on the show. Hopefully you can do so again after we fix the world and then decide that we're so rich from it that we have to destroy it again just to rebuild something new. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
We can just come back to discuss how we were right about everything that we said in this call.
Yeah.
My favorite kind of conversation. Let's talk about how good we are.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. Like, it's really validating to chat with such interesting and creative people who have such similar interests, and just to connect around those values and those goals means a lot to me.
Yes. Well, I am super looking forward to reading your book, Lee, and playing your game that I have been following with great interest, partly because we kind of had the same idea and you actually went ahead and did it. I have, like, design docs that look a lot like what I've seen coming out of your game, which is incredibly exciting. But yeah, I saw you and I'm like, oh, she's me.
I know, there's a lot of recognition there. So yeah, I've got to finish both of those things so that you can read them. Yeah,
exactly. And I'm going to be on top of you.
Okay.
Let's go. Yeah.
Let's do it.
This is how I am. I'm enthusiastic now. You're doomed.
Well, good. Enthusiasm and love for what we do is what keeps us doing it. So I think that's a good energy to share.
Lots and lots of love to all. Let's get on with our creative lives. Let's go to bed on one end and let's wake up on the other.
All sorts of different directions we can take.
Directional is hosted by Jörg Tittel in London, Chantal Ryan in Adelaide, and produced by Paul Bennin in Los Angeles for Rapid Eye Movers. The theme song was composed by Oliver Krauss and Frally Hines. Follow us on Twitter @directionalshow and listen to past episodes at directional.show. See you next time.